TSN 1290 presents the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg.
Good morning, Winnipeg. Good morning, Manitoba, and for all those joining us live this morning at tsn1290.ca, good morning, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my colleagues, Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Tim gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is, and we'll hear from producer Remus a little bit later in the program. 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday morning. The Jets and the Capitals, puck drop 2 p.m. on TSN 1290 this afternoon. Hustler and Lawless follow us. And our good friend Rick Ralph in the official Winnipeg Jets pregame show is at 1 p.m. Joining us on the program this morning from the Montreal Gazette, Pat Hickey, will be here at about 9:15 this morning. At 9:45, he's the voice of the Washington Capitals on Comcast Sportsnet out of Washington. Joe Beninati is going to be here. And then at 10:15... Jeremy Weiss from Weiss Tech Hockey is going to join us to talk about the Winnipeg Jets power play. We've had him do some video breakdown for us to really get deep inside the Jets power play and to see if we can figure out what ails it, because as we know, that power play has not been clicking. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and our website is www.illegalcurve.com. Gentlemen, Richard, Ezra, good morning, first of all. And before we get deep into hockey talk, I'm going to start with Ryan O'Reilly. What a nice surprise we had here this morning as we came in. Free cookies. Free cookies from our good friends at My Photo Cookie. You know, some great hockey design photo cookies here. And it was pretty much, we've been pretty open about the way to our heart, through our stomachs.
Ezzy would talk right now, but he's got two cookies right in his mouth.
Yeah, exactly right.
Absolutely. Thanks to the good folks at My Photo Cookies. I kind of wanted a picture of Drew on my cookie, but I'll settle for, you know, all of our favorite teams, the Jets. Well, mainly just the Jets is our favorite team, but I think we got one of almost every team, so that's awesome.
Why did you?
That is the way to our heart.
Why did you want to eat a cookie with Drew's face on it?
Yeah, it's a little odd.
I don't know. I think you're a good-looking guy and you're a friend. I mean, it's not nothing. We don't want to look too much into this, guys. I mean,
8:03 and the show's already off the rails.
Absolutely.
It's a good start.
Let's get it back on track, Drew.
All righty. Let's start off with the Ryan O'Reilly saga. And it certainly has been a saga since the CBA was signed and Ryan O'Reilly wasn't. But then it took a twist this week with Calgary signing Ryan O'Reilly to the offer sheet. But lo and behold, nobody knew. Well, that's actually a question I'm going to pose to you guys. Is did anybody know that Ryan O'Reilly was going to have to clear waivers if he was signed by another team?
But you know, I didn't. I didn't know. I mean, Chris Johnston obviously knew, but you know, we talked about this on Thursday night after the offer sheet was signed by Ryan O'Reilly with the Calgary Flames. The Calgary Flames and Jay Feaster claim they did their due diligence, but if they actually did do their due diligence, they probably would have known that he had to clear waivers if they didn't match the offer sheet. So obviously somebody didn't know.
Credit to Chris Johnson for breaking this. I guess it's a little bit confusing. The situation is confusing in any event, but I think it's especially confusing because of the memorandum of understanding. Because it's not really, you know, I'm not sure if that's public information or not. As far as I know, it's not. So what I had thought was that this rule, which was if you sign a player after this NHL season has begun and he's played overseas, he has to clear waivers. I thought that was rectified or amended somewhat, which it apparently was. To be the rule, just to explain to our listeners, the rule is you can't play if the NHL season starts, which it did on January 19th or 20th, right?
Yeah. Yep.
When the NHL season starts, if a player on your roster, so for example, Colorado's roster, O'Reilly, plays overseas, the rule in the previous CBA was that even that player would have to clear waivers before reporting to your squad. Now, the new CBA, or at least the Memorandum of Understanding, amended that rule to say your own players, if you sign them, could just come to your squad and didn't have to clear waivers. But they apparently didn't change the rule that if you signed a free agent, somebody else's free agent, or somebody who wasn't on your roster initially.
If you signed an RFA or...
Or a UFA or a who UFA wasn't on your roster.
Like Antti Miettinen last year with the
Jets. Exactly. That wouldn't change, and that player would have to go through waivers before reporting to your squad. For Calgary to have missed this... Drew, did I think of it when it happened? No. I'll admit that absolutely, but I'll say this. I'm not in an NHL front office with 5, 6, 7, 10, 12 guys who have to do their due diligence. And by that, I mean, you know, I said yesterday with Hustler, you have to look at O'Reilly and you say, okay, I want to sign O'Reilly. This is the player I want. And they tried to trade for him, according to Feaster. I want to sign him. So you go over and you say, okay, you know, when was the last time he played? Is he healthy? When was the last time he played? In the KHL after the season began. So all you do is make a phone call. And that's where I'm not so sure Calgary is telling the truth.
I think Calgary is trying to cover themselves at this point in time. But I do think at the same time that 28 other teams in the league, had they signed Ryan O'Reilly to this offer sheet, would have been in the exact same position. I don't think anybody knew. And NHL Central Registry didn't know. And they're the guys who, that's their only job, is to flag players who might have some sort of, you know, problem, for lack of a better word, in terms of returning to the NHL. That is their job. Mm-hmm. They provide a list or they provide a service to all 30 NHL teams where they put an asterisk next to some guy's name. You can sign this guy, but, and then there's the but. They didn't know about this either. So, I mean, all the snickering, the only person, as far as I can tell, that knew about this is Chris Johnson.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like, 30 other NHL teams... Greg Sherman certainly didn't know about this in Colorado.
But it wouldn't have, to me, it wouldn't have changed what Greg Sherman did. But for Greg Sherman, and we'll talk about the Colorado perspective next segment, but for Greg Sherman, the question is O'Reilly at that money worth a first and a third? And he deemed him to not be worth that. And he deemed him to be worth more, and he didn't accept the compensation.
Well, why don't we talk about the offer that Calgary presented? First of all, you know, it was a two-year deal.
Mm-hmm.
And the first year had minimal money. Well, it didn't have minimal money, no. But it had, you know, what did it have? I believe 3.5.
3.5.
And then
I believe 2.5 was a signing bonus.
Right.
So that's upfront money, and then $1 million a salary over the course of the year,
which would have been prorated to, right, you know, not a huge total.
Yeah.
So the you know, on a face, a 2-year, $10 million deal.
Remember though, signing bonus.
Yeah.
Is upfront money.
Right. You have to hand them a check for $2.5 million.
Remember, you're playing in a shortened season.
Right.
So it's kind of more than...
Yeah, it's got a double sort of, you know, a double effect on it, no doubt about it.
Think about that, though. It's not, you know, a shortened season, a signing bonus is essentially double the money.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially paying them for the whole year.
Right. That's fine, but I mean, you know, so the problem for, you know, normally you sign a guy to a 2-year, $10 million deal, no big deal, you know, it's probably a no-brainer to match.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why some people thought it wasn't a no-brainer to match is the is what it would require Colorado to qualify Ryan O'Reilly at after the 2-year contract expires. And that's what they're going to have to qualify him at, which is a minimum of $6.5 million.
That's assuming, and that's so just to explain to our listeners, when you're a restricted free agent,
mm-hmm,
for a team to retain your rights and keep you restricted on their roster, you have to qualify the player. And you have to qualify a player at Ryan O'Reilly's salary, you qualify him at the salary he made the previous season, meaning at minimum you're paying him $6.5 million
in 2014-2050.
And if you don't qualify him, he becomes an unrestricted free agent. He can go anywhere he wants.
And from a Winnipeg perspective, it's what they're going to have to do with Zach Bogosian after, mm-hmm, this season. They will have to qualify him.
And Wheeler,
exactly. They'll have to say in order to retain your rights,
yeah,
we're going to guarantee you X amount of dollars.
Right.
And that X is his current salary, I believe in their case, plus 10%, but I'm not 100% sure about
that. No, theirs is still, I think, too high. I think the 10% is around a lower figure.
Okay.
I don't have the exact wording in front of me.
So they'll just have to qualify Bogosian and Wheeler at the exact same, yeah, salary they make this year.
Yeah.
I think, guys, it's a very interesting amount. If you think about it, what Ryan O'Reilly was offered before the season started was 2 years, $7 million, which he and his agent rejected. Correct me if I'm wrong. This is according to Adrian Dater of the Denver Post. And apparently him and his agent, Riley and his agent, wanted 5 years, roughly, I think, in the $22 million to $24 million range. And he ends up getting a two-year, $10 million deal. So he obviously lost money by not playing half of the season. But for Ryan O'Reilly, this is a pretty good deal, what he's going to get in his second year. Again, it's already halfway through this season, and he's essentially going to be in the same position, after next year. But it's a pretty good deal for him, and if you think about it, it was probably worth it for him personally, financially, to hold out, because he's going to end up getting what he wanted, right?
Absolutely.
And there was a debate definitely in Calgary, Drew, over whether or not Ryan O'Reilly was worth this, and some people,
let me ask you guys that question. Right. Is Ryan O'Reilly worth this contract? And had he become a Calgary Flame, how does he fit into their system?
Well, it's funny, Richie. A lot of people, and I'm talking friends and even hockey people, not hockey media, but people that are, hockey players and a lot of people still don't even know who Ryan O'Reilly is. Ryan O'Reilly came into the league with the Colorado Avalanche and was playing on the third and fourth line. He had 26 points in his first year, and I believe 27 his second year, and then last year he led the team. And when Ryan O'Reilly was sitting out with the likes of Jamie Benn and PK Subban, people were saying, "Who is Ryan O'Reilly?" And he's a good hockey player, and he's more of a two-way player, but he also has a scoring touch. He was never a top junior scorer or considered a guy who was going to have the same scoring touch as a Landeskog or anything like that. He wasn't a high first-round pick. But Ryan O'Reilly is definitely the type of player that is coveted as a guy that maybe isn't going to be the best first-line center, but he could be a second-line center. So for the Calgary Flames right now, with the options that they have, I think, it was worth them to go out and sign a guy like that when you have other players that they've brought in, whether it's Cervenka or other guys, that haven't worked out. So obviously they thought, okay, we're kind of on the edge of making the playoffs. If we sign Ryan O'Reilly, I don't know necessarily that that could put us over the top, but it's probably an improvement over what we have. So I don't know if it's necessarily worth that amount of money that they offered him, but I think it was worth giving him an offer sheet.
They have a hold center. They've had a hold center for 10 years. They haven't had any real top two centers. Damon Lankow maybe at the highest. Craig Conroy. When was the last center they have? Seriously, like since Neuendijk. I said that yesterday with Hassel and Remus. So they're trying to figure out and they're trying to fit and finally get that center. Is Ryan O'Reilly worth a first and a third round pick? Well, the question is, what first round pick is that? And right now it's a high one. If you're going to give up a top five pick, you're done. I mean, that's it. Like, you're never going to live that down. If you're going to give up a 12 or 13 pick, if you're Calgary, you are paying him, you're overpaying him, you are getting the center you want.
Yep.
You have to make the playoffs and make that a really low pick to make it a worthwhile deal.
Calgary's 25th in the league right now.
Right. So if you stay there with him, he needs to get you into the playoffs this year. It's an all-in kind of play. Get you into the playoffs, make it a low pick you're giving up, and make you obviously some money in the playoffs, and prove that he can fill that center void. And I'm of the opinion that there was another contract coming there, that if Calgary got him, that he would have signed an extension.
That makes sense.
My opinion.
Right.
Well, I mean, because
sort of a handshake deal that
you say to the guy, if we get you here, we'd like to sign you longer.
So. Can they do that? Can you sign a guy and then almost rip up that contract for?
I think you just sign an extension on top of the deal, which is what you do.
Well, Drew, to Richie's point, if they don't do that, so now you've given up a first and a third round pick for essentially a year and a quarter. Keep in mind, this isn't 2 years. This is a year and a quarter essentially. So you have to sign him because he's a restricted free agent.
Well, it's inflationary, and what you're doing with RFAs is you're overpaying. Salary-wise, and you're paying draft pick-wise. And that's why, as a GM, you have to really look at what you're doing and say, is it worth it? And to me, I don't think it really is ever worth it to do this, because basically what you're doing to get a guy, I know we got to go to breakthrough, to get a guy, you have to overpay him at such a level that the team that has them thinks it's beyond the realm of reasonableness, the amount of money you're giving him, okay? And then you're giving up draft picks on top of that. So you're overpaying, And you're giving up draft pick compensation. Draft pick compensation, that's the currency of the new CBA.
Yep.
So it is an all-in type deal, and I think Calgary dodged a bullet here in a number of ways.
Regardless of the waiver issue.
And have only added fuel to the fire of contract, the salary structure, the internal salary structure of the National Hockey League.
Let's go to Richie. Sorry, I was just quickly. 2 years, 10 mil is a lot of high price to pay. But I agree with Richie. The high price to pay is also those draft picks. And I think I agree. They dodged a bullet, maybe.
Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to look at this from the Colorado perspective. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. 20 minutes past the top of the hour. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Spent the first segment talking about the Ryan O'Reilly offer sheet from the Calgary Flames perspective, a great article by our friend George Johnson in the Calgary Herald today. And George doesn't sugarcoat things. You can actually almost hear his just the frustration he has with his team in the course of the writing of the article. So we'll tweet that out on our Twitter feed, at Illegal Curve.
Any notable quotes in there?
Bob Hartley, I mean, because you got to keep in mind that the Flames and the Avs played each other on Thursday night right after this offer sheet was made. And the Flames had a big lead, and then they lost that lead to the Avs. They gave up 3 goals in the third period to lose 5-4. Mm-hmm. They had a 4-2 lead and a 3-0 lead. Just, he says that the job has clearly taken a toll on Jay Feaster. He inherited an unholy mess from predecessor Daryl Sutter. That's a comment from Johnson. I mean, we didn't get to it, really, but we can talk about it for a couple minutes. What are the Calgary Flames? Are they just still this team that's going to be destined to finish each year between 10th and 12th in the Western Conference and never get better and never get worse until Ginla finally hangs it up?
Richie, I think the Calgary Flames are in denial that it might be the best thing to trade Jerome Ginla. Or part with Jerome Ginla, he's a pending unrestricted free agent, and start the rebuild. They've continued to go after it, and they're probably not a good enough team to make the Western Conference playoffs, Stanley Cup playoffs of the Western Conference. But right now, they are a middling team, and they have been for a long time. Since 2004, 2005, when they went on the run, sorry, that was actually 2003, 2004, when they went on the run, they haven't gotten out of the first round. They haven't ever recaptured that run against the Tampa Bay Lightning. And it seems to me like they think that if they pick up Yuri Hudler and Dennis Wiedemann, that's going to change a lot. And it hasn't. And I think we knew it wasn't.
Dennis Wiedemann, I mean, they're paying big money for a second-pairing defenseman. He's second-pairing there right now with TJ Brody. And what'd you pay him? You paid him big money. And I'll pull up the exact salary now. Whatever it was, it made me fall out of my chair when I saw it the first time.
We laughed about it on the show. We audibly were laughing on air about when we saw that contract.
He's a nice player. He's fine. But you gave him $5.25 a year for the next 5 years. So $26.5 million for 5 years. I mean, what did he do to warrant that contract? Again, Calgary is doing a nice job of ruining the salary scale around the National Hockey League. But back to Colorado, Drew.
Yeah.
And we're going Colorado's perspective here, and I think what you're looking at is a huge effect on the contracts, and I think this was intentional.
By Calgary, you're saying.
Of Matt Duchene also and Gabriel Landeskog, in that when O'Reilly's a free agent, when he's an RFA next, he is an RFA at the same time as both Landeskog and Duchene. And if the Avalanche have to qualify him at $6.5 million. What do you think Duchene wants? What do you think Landeskog wants? And where are you left with that? And they can't trade him for a year, remember.
They can they're stuck. Is it 12 months? Is it a calendar year that they have to wait in order to trade him?
I actually think it is, but that's a good question. I'll have to look into that.
I believe it is as well, and you know what that means?
Yeah.
Is trade that deadline. It's after the trade deadline probably next year that they won't be able to deal him until. Which means when are you trading him? Are you trading his rights in the off season after next year?
That's a huge element to this, Richie. I mean, that's a
the
very
timing.
Good point.
You can't trade the guy.
You can't trade him essentially. Until you can't trade him.
That's the part that, I mean, now we don't know for sure when the trade deadline is next year, and Colorado may end up dodging a bit of a bullet there, but I believe it is 12 months to the day from the signing of the contract. Mm-hmm. You're not able to trade him after he's been offer sheeted. Same thing that happened with, remember, with Shea Weber in this offseason, everyone's saying, you know, okay, well, Nashville can just trade him. Well, you can't just trade him that easily. You have to hold on to him for a year, and that's why Nashville was on the hook for paying him something like $30 million in the course of that 1 year that they weren't able to trade him.
I think Richie makes a very valid point, as he does in almost every show. Actually, every show. Gabriel Landeskog is up for a contract. Matt Duchene is up for a contract, Richie, because he signed that bridge contract. And I think this is what it was all about. As far as Ryan O'Reilly goes in the Colorado Avalanche and Greg Sherman, that's why I think they couldn't come to an agreement. They were about, what, $1.5 million, $2 million a season apart. I mean, there was a serious discrepancy. Ryan O'Reilly saying, you know, I led the team in scoring. I had a good year in my third year in the NHL. It was unexpected. Now I'd like to get paid, you know, basically almost a Vander Kane money. He was looking for $4.5, $5 million a year, and they were saying, hold on a second. We're not going to pay you that much money. That's probably what we're going to pay Landeskog or Duchene. I don't think you could. I mean,
when we talk about Landeskog and Duchene in that context,
they're better players.
That's right. That's what we're saying. Is you know, and Anaheim was always sort of established that benchmark with their last Getzlaff, Perry, and Ryan contracts. Is that they gave Getzlaff and Perry the bigger money, and they said to Bobby Ryan, "You're not going to make as much as those guys." Mm-hmm. You know, that's you slot guys based on sort of the hierarchy of talent. And what this has done to Colorado is it has completely screwed up their slotting system for their hierarchy.
Right.
That's pretty much it in a nutshell, right?
That's exactly right. And completely intentional.
Of course. And Jay Feaster's no fool.
No.
Jay Feaster knows exactly what he has to do and, you know, in order to make it unpalatable for Colorado to sign a guy. Now, they ended up doing it anyways, but I don't have any problem with what Jay Feaster did here. My quibble would be, yeah, you've sort of thrown the RFA salary structure out of whack, but, you know, that's going to happen anytime you sign a guy to an offer sheet.
Well, it will. And to, you know, to that point, Drew, what you're doing when you sign the offer sheet is you're trying to get the player, and that's your best option, right, is to inflate it in such a way.
Yes.
Similar to when the Rangers signed Joe Sakic, also an Avalanche player. What they did was, I believe it was $21 million for 3 years, and I believe the payment was like $17 million in the first year, like a $10 million signing bonus, whatever it was. So the idea was to load it up so Colorado couldn't pay it all at once, and MSG and Cablevision could. It happened to be that they matched in any event, And the Rangers were doing that to replace, and it was kind of a similar situation in the sense that the Rangers, for whatever reason back then, let Mark Messier go to Vancouver.
Right.
And they had a huge gap at center.
Right.
So they loaded up a lot of money. Now Ryan O'Reilly isn't Joe Sakic, but the idea is kind of the same on, you know, less money actually today than it was back then, but that's what they were trying to do.
That was the good old days where the Wild West, when you could... guys to that much money.
Look at what, I mean, Philly did it just this offseason with Nashville.
Yep.
They said to Nashville and they said it, and you know, knowing that if they had matched, they weren't able then to just go and dump his contract or anything. They said, you want this guy, it's going to cost you $28 million in the course of this next calendar year. You know, and that's using the system in the manner that it's designed. So I don't think that, you know, somebody was tweeting about, oh, Greg Sherman and Jay Feaster barn fight, you know, like how Kevin Lowe and Brian Burke were allegedly going to do it after the Dustin Penner signing. This is the system. This is the system. Use it to better your team. Yeah, it screws everything else, but, you know, unfortunately, those are the rules of the game.
Yeah, that the Kevin Lowe situation was way completely different. But, you know, Richie, you know, we're talking the Colorado perspective, right? And they've matched the offer, so now Ryan O'Reilly is, I think he might play Sunday. I'm not sure about that. I think that's when he's first eligible to play Sunday for the Avalanche. But now they've matched the offer, so the Avalanche will have him now for, you know, roughly 28, 29 games.
Yeah, it's one calendar year, guys.
One calendar year
in order
for him to be traded.
Yeah.
You know, so the Avalanche are going to have O'Reilly, and then a year from now he's going to be an RFA. Okay, so what do they do?
Right.
Now they're going to be in a situation where they've already signed Landeskog, they've already signed Duchene, and after what you went through with Ryan O'Reilly for the last 4 months, are you going to sign him or are you going to trade him? I don't know. I mean, I think you'd think, well, how could you possibly match that and not re-sign him? But how are you going to also pay him that much money? Then you're going to have three highly paid forwards all at $7 million a year.
And you better believe that Matt Duchene's agent and Gabriel Landeskog's agents, I don't know who they are off the top of my head, they're not going to say, oh, well, you know, we're going to give you a discount here.
No.
We're going to say, hey, we're better than this player, and that's what we want. And and when I talk about the salary structure, think about arbitration. When you go into arbitration, there'll be more players who are making less than O'Reilly than more, but O'Reilly is a factor in that decision. He'll raise the average annual salary significantly for the type of player that you're arguing about. And O'Reilly is, you know, a guy who was, I think he was the first pick of the second round,
of the second round.
Out of Erie, and I know Sherry Bass and thinks highly of him. I know he's a Don Cherry favorite. He does all the little things really well, but he's not going to be that top point guy. So that's a factor, too, in this negotiation, and what are the intangibles worth, and can you quantify, you can't quantify intangibles, and in salary arbitration, it's more so tangible evidence than the intangibles that pay, so... There's certainly far-reaching. This is a decision by Calgary that has a significant effect on the rest of the league.
Yeah,
and it's an inflationary tool, and it rarely works.
It's true. It does rarely work. But you know what? He thought it was an opportunity for him to improve his team. So I don't fault him for going for it. It's just the collateral damage that is as a result of going for it.
But I mean, look at it from both perspectives, Drew.
Yeah.
You know, O'Reilly comes to Calgary, and then he inflates their salary structure.
Absolutely. I mean, it's handing leverage, which is the word we use often on this program in regards to negotiation. It's handing leverage that a team has. It's just giving it to a player instead. And not just that one player, a lot of other players as a result, like you mentioned, Landeskog and Duchene. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest NHL and Winnipeg Jets news. The Winnipeg Jets morning papers have been posted. Is IllegalCurve.com. Sorry, Richie?
I just want to quickly clarify. You're looking further. You look at the, memorandum of understanding. The notes they have here on the collective bargaining agreement. This is the waivers clause that I think is applicable here. And that says this, Drew, just before we go to the next segment. All players on a club's reserve list and restricted free agent list will be exempt from the application of CBA Rule 13.23 waivers in the case of a mid-season signing. So they say for further clarity, and they provide an example. If Club A trades such a player to Club B, and Club B signs the player to a standard player contract, such player will be exempt from the application of CBA 13.23. The distinction there is when you match the offer sheet, you can't trade the player.
Right.
So technically speaking, and so people understand, if Colorado trades O'Reilly before matching, this doesn't happen because then O'Reilly becomes a Calgary Flame player.
Right.
He's on their list, their roster, and they can sign him
like
without going away.
Like somebody where we've seen people get their rights traded, oftentimes right before unrestricted free agency opens. In fact, the Jets acquired Jonas Gustafsson.
Yep.
So they acquire his rights. He doesn't have a contract per se, but he is still property of now the Jets, and the Jets have that window of opportunity in order to try and sign him before he hits the free agent market.
Had they known about the rule and had they been working together, which they obviously weren't because Colorado wasn't happy about this, I assume.
Yeah.
All they could have done is make literally a trade for a first and a third round pick and not have them match the offer.
Right.
And then just sign him to that contract.
That's right.
So
as opposed to, you're right, it's just sort of a bit of an end around the waivers process there.
Yeah.
But neither of them were aware of that, and it didn't work out. This segment of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show is brought to you by Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza, home of Canada's only coal-fired pizza oven. Taste the difference at Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza, 1580 Taylor Avenue. Pizza baked, well done. You can be sure to check out the Carbone website at Carbone, C-A-R-B-O-N-E, coalfiredpizza.com.
NHL News and Notes.
NHL news and notes for this Saturday morning. We're going to start with the Dallas-Edmonton game from a couple of nights ago where Jamie Benn laid a pretty solid cross check. right into the back, right into the spine of Ryan Jones of the Edmonton Oilers. Did you guys think that it deserved a suspension?
Yeah, I did, Drew, and I love Jamie Benn's game. I've talked about his game on the show for a long time. But Ryan Jones' back was turned, and I think this is a hitting from behind thing that gets overlooked a lot. Concussions are getting a ton of attention, and rightfully so. Hitting from behind is still an issue. I think twofold. One is that players are now turning into these hits to take penalty, to get to draw penalties.
Something we spoke about on our Wednesday show.
Which I hate. Because if you were when you play hockey as a youngster, you're taught to protect yourself from those hits. And the players know the rules in terms of the rules of trying to protect yourself, and they're not following them. But the second thing is Jones has absolutely no idea that Ben's there. And it's a pretty hard cross-check. And the biggest worry, and this applies to concussions too, is when you don't brace yourself for something like that.
The whiplash effect?
And I think if it was the other way, I always think about it from this perspective. If Ryan Jones, Jamie Benn's in the offensive zone, and Ryan Jones comes out of nowhere and gives him a cross-check like that, there's no doubt in my mind that he's suspended. And it shouldn't be a double standard.
There will be a hearing about it today. I expect that he will probably get a game. I wouldn't think he'd get more than one game, maybe two.
No, not more than one, I don't think.
Yeah. But it's a pretty solid cross-check right in the small of the guy's back. And the context, I think, matters as well. Dallas is frustrated. Mm-hmm. They're down 5-1 when this incident occurred in, I think, Thursday night's game, if I'm not mistaken.
Similar to Taylor Hall, you know, when he's hitting Cal Clutterbuck, he's frustrated 3-1 at the end of a game. You can't be taking on any other team like that.
No, absolutely not. On Wednesday night, Mike Milbury had some harsh words for Alex Ovechkin. Here's some audio from what Mike Milbury said, and then we'll discuss if we agree with his assessment or not.
This is an awful display of hockey by Alex Ovechkin. He should be ashamed of himself. A blind pass, eight-year-olds don't do this in the offensive zone. No fight in this guy along the wall here. I know they played three and four nights, but that's no excuse. And when you're a big star like this, you don't have to act like a baby. This is ridiculous embellishment. He should be embarrassed by this, and so should his teammates. That is silly. That you get up and act like a man, for God's sake. And this one, move your butt along the wall. You're just standing there. I've seen this for 3 years. You'd think somebody would figure this out and tell him that he's got to move. And look at the effort on the back check there. Are you kidding me? This is a guy that makes a ton of money. He owes it to his owner. He owes it to his coach. And watch him change, line change on the goal. That is inexcusable behavior, inacceptable for a guy, for a coach, especially a rookie coach like Adam Oates. That guy ought to be held accountable.
So, Mike Milbury certainly isn't one to hide his opinions, and he has oftentimes been accused of being a bloviator. Do you think that he is justified in his comments about Alex Ovechkin from Wednesday night?
You know, I drew. Easy for me to say. I think that some people, Mike Milbury had his tenure as general manager on the island, and it wasn't successful by any means. But I think it also need to take into account the fact that people look at him as this old-fashioned guy who's in favor of fighting. He's actually not as in favor of fighting as some may think. He doesn't like the stage stuff. And so I think you can at least take his opinion seriously. And I think on this point, give him credit. He's calling out Alexander Ovechkin, to me, you know, calling him out rightfully so. There are things that he's not doing out there. And they have become a habit. You know, one game, two games, this is a couple seasons now. And he doesn't back check, doesn't move his feet. You know, he may not have back checked back at his peak, but he was always moving his feet, always skating hard, always doing a lot of things. I don't think anybody in this room or in the hockey world thinks he's the same player he was a couple of years ago. And I think some people believe that to be an effort thing, a matter of caring.
Got soft.
The natural talent is there, and I have no issue at all with Mike Milbury calling out Alexander Ovechkin. And you know what? He's using examples. He's not just with broad strokes.
Yep.
Using examples, showing video, and he's got passion behind it, and I don't mind that.
Yeah, Richie, oftentimes Mike Milbury bothers me, and you know, it's because I a lot of the time I don't disagree with the way he views hockey. You know, when he played in the NHL, he was a tough hockey player, and he could back it up with his fists. But he can be a blowhard at sometimes. But, you know, I agree with Richie, who agrees with Milbury. Alexander Ovechkin is almost a once-in-a-lifetime talent. And when he came into the NHL after the lockout, I mean, everybody remembers the goals, you know, the goal he scored on the back or the other, you know, 55 goals he scored that year, scored 65 in a year. And Alexander Ovechkin, as recent as 2 years ago, on this show, we were talking about who's better, Crosby or Ovechkin. Now nobody's talking about that. It's Crosby and Malkin and Stamkos.
The only people who are going to be talking about it will be the fans of today's game when they probably chant Crosby's better at him.
Yeah, and
the list is the list is long of players that are better than him.
That's right.
Right, and you know, I think it needs to be said when a guy is not back checking, he's not giving a full effort. And I think Richie touched on it with what he said about his effort level. I think bad habits that developed earlier on in his career have gotten worse as he's gotten a little bit older. And now he's not able to mask them because he's not scoring as many goals. So now he's not only is he not scoring, even though he had a hat trick last week, now the defensive deficiencies are starting to rear their ugly head because he's not scoring as much. And I think, the only guy that can change that is Ovechkin. A guy like Adam Oates can come in, and he's a smart hockey guy, but, Adam Oates can't go on the ice and skate and back check for Ovechkin.
It's old dogs and new tricks, the old story. It's hard to get them to learn them.
It's also adjusting. We've talked about it on the show, adjusting. And players adjust with time. The league adjusts to them, and they have to adjust to the league.
That's right.
I don't think he's really adjusted to the league. I mean, some will tell you that Ken Hitchcock's strategy of putting a big body on him in the neutral zone and playing him a certain way in the 2010 Olympics was copied by many teams, and that Ovechkin just doesn't really care enough to change the way he plays, and that's been a reason why he struggled. But in any event, he has demonstrated to me there's a little bit of a lack of pride here, Drew, too. It's rest on your laurels. I don't know what it is, but I'm reading Roy McGregor's book. It's called Wayne Gretzky's Ghost. It's a compilation of Roy McGregor's articles over the years, and it's amazing to see. There's a couple articles in there talking about Crosby and Ovechkin, how Ovechkin's actually the most exciting player in the game, and it's amazing to see 3-4 years later how that narrative has completely changed.
You know what? And it's funny you mention effort and everything else. I expect that the Olympics next year in Sochi, Alex Ovechkin might be the best player there. I think I expect him to be dominant. He's talked about the Olympics in Sochi for about 5 years now.
I don't think you can turn it on.
Well, we'll find out. But it's been a number of years now that he's talked about, even if the NHL doesn't go, I'm going. Because that's really been the big thing that's been driving him as of late, I think. And I bet you in Sochi, he's going to be a dominant player.
But I don't think in the NHL or in pro sports, you can just turn it on and turn it off like that. I don't think it works that way.
And that might be the problem right there. He thinks he can just turn it on and not back check or not hit, and he's not able to turn it on. He hasn't. You said you mentioned adapting, Richie. There's adapting with watching film and saying, okay, you need to be here on the ice, you need to do this on the ice. Then there's also putting in the work.
Yeah,
we know Alexander Ovechkin isn't exactly the guy who's staying late in the gym and doing all the little things that other guys that don't have as much talent as him are doing. I mean, because he doesn't have to. He's that talented that he can get by with showing up to the rink whenever, and he's got, otherworldly skill that most guys don't have. And I think that's one of the big things that he does rest on. He thinks, okay, well, I had a bad game. I'm Alexander Ovechkin. I can just step it up. I think ego's involved, too.
When your bad season is still 30 goals, 35 goals.
Exactly.
Yeah, then the complaining only goes so far. The problem is when that's aligned with a $10 million contract.
That's right. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Birchwood Chevrolet Buick GMC game day here on TSN 1290. 10 minutes before the top of the hour. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Ezra Ginsberg to my left. Richard Pollock to my far left. And this segment of the program is brought to you by our good friends at Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. Rob Schneider in town this weekend. Completely sold out. All the shows have been sold out. Thank you, Winnipeg, for making Rob Schneider's appearance at Winnipeg. Pardon me, at Rumors. Just a tremendous success. Gentlemen, you will be there tomorrow night. You'll see the 7 o'clock show tomorrow night. You guys psyched to see Rob Schneider?
How long will it take Ezzy to yell, you can do it in the middle of the routine?
I assume he's going to do it even before Rob Schneider's even there.
I'm beyond excited. I grew up in that era of Adam Sandler, Rob Schneider, Chris Farley. For me, this is it doesn't get any better than this. Very pumped up.
And your brother, Zach Galifianakis.
Exactly.
It's actually a spitting image with that beard.
I just want to say quickly, I know we got to move on, but some people are giving me, telling me that I should keep the beard going, one of them being a former analyst on this station, Abby Khan, who has a beard. I went to ShawarmaCon. And he was telling me, I tweeted out that I was going to shave my beard, and he said, you know what? Keep it. It's good. So shout out to Abby Khan. Shout out to everybody who supports the beard.
You need to trim the beard, though, Izzy.
That's true.
I don't really care if you keep. Like, I still have a beard. I've just been trimming the beard. That's really all anybody's ever asked for.
Yeah, you kept the beard, too. You're going to keep it, aren't you?
I'm going to trim it, though. It's not going to look as, well,
disgusting as mine.
Yeah, the words can't even do that thing justice. Couple of comments. Our good friend Beller on Twitter sent us a comment, said, rather than a Crosby's better chant, how about a Ladd is better or a Kane is better chant today at the Jets game? I thought that was a pretty good comment. And, you know, he's not wrong. You know, chant one of those guys. Those guys at least put out, generally speaking, will put out more of an effort than Ovechkin. But
this year they've both been better.
Yeah. The only problem with that, this year they have both been better. The only problem is sometimes you wake the beast. You know, you wake the beast a little bit, and, you know, Mario's pool boy, you know, sometimes you wake the beast when it comes to, you know, with Crosby, and you don't want to do that so often. It can come back to bite you.
We'll talk about the keys to the game later.
Yeah, that's right. We'll talk about the keys to the game a little bit later on in the program. Let's talk about the Chicago Blackhawks, you know, because with the exception of making fun of Richie for predicting that they weren't going to make the playoffs, we have sort of overlooked what they've done so far.
Mm-hmm. 21 games.
Yeah, 21 games in a row that they've registered a point.
Right.
You know, and Richie, you ask the question here, is this the most impressive streak in hockey in the last 10 years? I think it has to be. I mean, 21 straight games registering a point? I can't think of much more impressive on a team level than that.
And, well, the reason it's kind of the question's posed, Drew, is because, you know, in this day and age with the salary cap and teams being so evenly matched on a night-to-night basis, this type of sustained success is almost unheard of.
Yep.
And they're doing it with, obviously, you know, they've had pretty good health luck so far. I mean, I know Crawford left the game the other night and Bolin's missed a couple, and Hosts obviously had that issue. But overall, they're best players. And maybe that's something that, you know, wasn't taken into account, certainly by me and maybe some others. I don't know. Probably mostly by me. Is that, you know,
you're hoping there's others.
Yeah, Taves last year, you know, he's hurt. And Hosts obviously gets hurt in the playoffs there. But when was the last time you really saw this team's core play together, right? You have Keith and Seabrook healthy in your second pairing of Chalmerson and then Oduya, and then you have Taves and Kane and Hossa and Sharp and Boland. For the most part, all those guys have been healthy all year. And then they've been getting, you know, productions from guys like, you know, Brandon Saad and Victor Stahlberg, excuse me, and different players.
Brian Bickle's got 10 points.
Yeah, Brian Bickle, I mean, that's
scored last night.
Toronto boy, and you know, my issue with the Hawks, still a little bit, is you know, they kind of seem to have a lot of pieces in place. I'm not so sure that. I'm talking about cup wise, Drew. There's some concerns, but talent wise, I mean, you can't argue with their top four and their top six. That's what, and you never do argue. And Dave Bowen, one of my favorite players in the game, because he can really play a nice two way game, really good against the Sedins and certain other matchups. Really good offensively for a dynamic third line checking center. But really is a second-line center. And there's so many pieces there that can get done. Now, their goaltending, of course, also has to be spoken about because that's the question mark going into the year, is the goaltending. And there are people in the league, I think, are still not convinced that Corey Crawford, who struggled mightily against Phoenix last year, can do the job. And then Ray Emery, can he do the job maybe in a game, maybe two games? But with his health issues of the past, is Ray Emery a guy who can take you to the promised land? Because for the Hawks, first or second round victory isn't successful. They want a cup. Well, and I don't think Emery can be the guy to take you on a long journey. So it really has to be Crawford. And there are still going to be doubters that Crawford can do the job.
When you win when you get points in 21 straight games, the expectations increase along with your point total. So you're right. No longer is it, you know, really right now, you know, after this start, you know, it's almost got to be Stanley Cup or at least Western Conference Final or bust for the Chicago Blackhawks, unless they enter into just the most amazing tailspin in the last half of this year.
Well, are they 10 points, somebody said, out of the possibly qualifying for the playoffs based on last year's projections?
Yeah. Well, 54, 55 points is kind of what is expected to need to get into the playoffs, Richie. So, yeah, 10, 12 points, whatever it is, they're not that far off. But I think you make a lot of valid points, Richie, about the Chicago Blackhawks. They're getting, not only are they getting good goaltending, Ray Emery got the win versus the Columbus Blue Jackets last night. They're getting good goaltending from two goalies right now. And let's not mince words. The Chicago Blackhawks outplayed the Phoenix Coyotes last in the first round, and they lost because Crawford was horrible. I mean, I think Crawford's been very good this year, but he was horrible last year in the playoffs. And that's why, you know, I said when we did our season preview show, I thought that the Blackhawks were going to go out and get a goaltender possibly early on in the season if they struggled, or later on close to the trade deadline. I don't think I wouldn't be as confident, you know, in the Blackhawks if they don't get another goaltender. But they have so much depth, and you know, Duncan Keith is playing Norris-like again. Brent Seabrook is, you know, the Brent Seabrook that from a couple of years ago. Jonathan Toews right now is carrying the team on his back. Patrick Kane is scoring, you know, a lot, even though he didn't score a lot yesterday. But there's so much depth there. Marion Hossa, just go Patrick Sharp, go up and down the roster. But you know, Drew, just for the streak alone, is very impressive. Richie mentioned it, the parity and all that. But I still think the Hawks, even though they lost in the first round last year and they lost to the Canucks the year before that, I still think they had aspirations of going far.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the streak, I think for everyone else's everyone else's expectations raises it definitely.
If you look at the Blackhawks roster, and you know, obviously you know, don't want to tinker with it too much.
Mm-hmm. No.
What would they be looking for, you know, at a trade deadline, just to sort of where's their areas of improvement needed without really upsetting the apple cart?
Looking for a little probably more checkers kind of in on the lower depth lines, 3-4 lines. Maybe you have too many guys who are, you know, you have Bickle, you have Stauber, you have all those guys, but at some point maybe those guys aren't producing and they aren't doing too many other things for you.
So those guys aren't your traditional, you know, checking line players.
That's right.
They need sort of more of a shutdown guy at that point.
And maybe, you know, guys who can fit that bill a little better. But I mean, you know, you're speaking from a position of haven't lost the game, so
that's right.
And do they want to probably add somebody on the back end for depth purposes? Probably a good idea. You know, when you have Letty and the guys that they have there, I mean, you're stationed pretty well. You're looking pretty good, but at the same time, injuries on the defense happen all the time. And if you look at past years with Vancouver and things like that, you don't have guys 7-8 even to be able to take the spot. And that's trouble, because if you play a team, for example, like in L.A., who's going to wear you down below that hash marks game after game after game and does have some lines, they can't really score a ton. But they do have some lines that can wear you down. You want to be able to have those third-pairing guys you trust. Or even like in Anaheim, who's got a lot of offense running at you all the time. Or Detroit. So those are beggars, you know.
It's a good problem.
Beggars can't be choosers for the other teams. For Chicago, it's the opposite.
Right.
You know, they can be picky with what they need, and it really won't cost them too much. Whereas every other team in the league, they're going to kind of take what's around. You know,
right.
Think about it. You have so many needs, you're going to try and address one or two, and whatever's available. Whereas Chicago, they have maybe one or two. Are they needs? No. Maybe they don't need it, but they'd like it.
Yeah, they're luxury upgrades more than they are glaring holes by any stretch.
But.
Yeah.
The question really is Corey Crawford the guy? Because he's played too well to not be the guy. So you're kind of between a rock and a hard place, right? If you're sold on him, then you feel good. But if you're not sold on him, he's kind of played well enough that you have to give him a shot, and you get to the playoffs. And you know how it is in the playoffs, guys? You can have the best season ever.
Yeah.
In game one of the playoffs, he lets in one bad goal, you lose 3-2. The narrative and the feeling in the dressing room completely changes, because as we saw last year, the 8th seed, LA Kings, that's the 8th seed. So you can be Chicago all you want, and the 8th seed this year, I mean, could be the Kings again, for God's sake. One bad game, LA's feeling good, you're not feeling so good.
It's the most difficult decision that Stan Bowman's going to have to make. Has he played well enough to earn your trust, and do you think he can duplicate it in the playoffs, which he didn't do last year? And if you bring someone in, what does that do to the team's confidence and all that? So I'm not so sure now that, you know, the way it stands now, the Blackhawks are going to go out and get a goalie. They might just stick with what they've got. But Richie's right. I think there's only a few tweaks to be made. How many changes could you have to make when you're undefeated in the regulation in 21 games? But it's a good problem for them to have.
But one other point, it also sometimes can be a difficult part of it because you've played so well, you don't want to change things, but you still may feel like there's a need that you or a want that you haven't addressed, and you're worried about the chemistry factor, mm-hmm. and maybe if the team was struggling, it'd be easier to address an issue. You know, it's like a coach won't change the roster if he's won 10 in a row, even if he sees a player who really isn't carrying his weight because he doesn't want to ruin that it factor.
Yeah, I hear you. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 1 hour down, 2 hours to go on TSN 1290. Down 2 hours to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Still to come in 15 minutes time, Pat Hickey from the Montreal Gazette. 9:45, Joe Beninati from Comcast Sportsnet out of Washington. And then at 10:15, Jeremy Weiss from Weiss Tech Hockey is going to break down the Jets power play with us. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com. This segment is brought to you by the Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba. The CGA Association of Manitoba is the largest, fastest growing, and most diverse accounting body in the province. Did you know that CGAs are among the top 5% of income earners in Canada with an average yearly salary of $72,000 for new graduates? For more information, contact the CGA Association of Manitoba at cga-manitoba.org or give them a call at 204-477-1256. The CGA Association of Manitoba, we see more than numbers. Gentlemen, a number of weeks ago, about 2 weeks ago at this time, we were debating who the Winnipeg Jets were going to draft in the top three. Was it going to be Seth Jones? Was it going to be Nathan MacKinnon? Or was it going to be Jonathan Drouin? Obviously, to the Jets' credit, that conversation has been put on the back burner since this winning streak that they've been going on. They're now obviously back into a playoff spot. But that still doesn't mean that the top three of this draft, that discussion isn't one that we cannot have. Craig Button, TSN draft expert, frequent guest on this program, really a great, just great insight into the game of hockey, says that Seth Jones is the most unique defenseman he's seen since Chris Pronger. If you're a general manager, Jones, MacKinnon, or Drouin?
Richie, I'll jump in here first. We've seen all of these guys play now, whether it's in the WHL or in the World Junior Championships. And Jonathan Drouin, to his credit, has gotten himself into the conversation for a top three pick, even though I think people have it really more so between Jones and MacKinnon. And, you know, Craig Button, who watches more hockey and prospects than almost anyone, you know, is high on Seth Jones for his athleticism. And, you know, you look at Seth Jones and his skating ability and his playmaking ability and his ability to make plays, it is really a unique thing. And, you know, he was a guy that started playing hockey later, and he might not have the numbers to back it up, you know, like MacKinnon and Drouin do right now. But right now, I mean, Seth Jones, you can see the potential in him. And, you know, Tyler Seguin, Taylor Hall, a few years back, you know, everybody was saying Taylor Hall, and then now it looks like Tyler Seguin, you can make an argument he's a better player than Taylor Hall, or at the very least, they're fairly even. Taylor Hall hasn't separated himself. But, you know, Seth Jones could really change a team's outlook very quickly on the back end. I mean, you could draft Seth Jones. He could become your best defenseman within a year or two. So as far as, you know, there's a lot smarter hockey, you know, scouts and all that are going to rank these guys higher than I would. But right now, I don't think you're going to go wrong drafting Seth Jones, especially if you have a weak hole on the back end, which a lot of teams do right now.
Craig Button describes Chris Pronger as the type of defenseman who can control the game, but then he says about Drouin...
Seth Jones, not Pronger.
What did I say?
Chris Pronger. Oh, sorry. Okay. Craig Button describes Seth Jones as a type of defenseman who can control the game like Chris Pronger did.
Right.
Sorry, let me rephrase again. Jonathan Drouin, he says his strongest asset is his intelligence, his hockey intelligence. Mm-hmm. He describes him as there's nobody smarter than this guy.
Well, and then you get into the hockey theory, right? And that's what do you value most? Do you value talent? Do you value character?
Smarts.
You know, hockey smarts, hockey speed, size. There's so many factors, and every organization will have a different ranking. Well, some will have the same, but you'll see a lot of variety in terms of the perspectives of what makes a great player. I don't think if you're any team in the league, you draft based on need. If you think Seth Jones will be the best player and you have two really good defensemen, you draft Seth Jones.
What about the Columbus Blue Jackets, Richie? They get the first overall pick. Let's forget the lottery for a second. Yeah. Let's just take a team like the Columbus Blue Jackets. They've got an embarrassment of riches on defense. Okay, so do you not draft Seth Jones because you need a center? To your point, I think if you think Seth Jones is going to be a better NHLer 5 years from now, you take Seth Jones. So now you have four really good defensemen. So I think you're right. I mean, I don't think whether they're Columbus Blue Jackets or you're the Colorado Avalanche, whoever is getting the low pick, the Islanders, pick any team who right now is, Islanders aren't doing as bad as bottom five, but I think you do draft the best player, and I think a lot of teams are going to be scared away by taking a defenseman too high, and they're going to say, okay, well, Nathan MacKinnon or Drouin, we like their offensive ability and the need that they're going to fill at center, but I think you're right. You take the best player available, and I think we see year after year that's not the case.
Seen Seth Jones play with the Under 16s it was in Winnipeg, and seen Seth Jones play in the World Juniors. To me, he's the most impressive of the bunch, and that's not to say that MacKinnon and Drouin aren't impressive and some of the other players that are available. But Seth Jones, to me, is like another worldly talent. He skates, he can move the puck, he can hit, and he's mature, and he's got a great kind of personality and attitude. It seems like, you have to remember, too, his dad, Popeye Jones, played in the National Basketball Association. But there's a maturity there that goes along with that. And Popeye Jones, for people who don't know, was one of the more beloved basketball players in Toronto and where he played. Well-respected. And so it seems like his son has inherited a certain amount of those traits. And to me, I mean, if you listen to a Seth Jones interview, he is more mature than the other players who are going to be drafted as well.
There's something to be said for an athletic pedigree. He's seen his dad go through what it takes to be a professional athlete day in and day out. So there isn't, the learning curve is not as steep as it might be for some of these other guys who, obviously are talented and obviously know, what it takes, but they might not fully know until you actually are there on a day in, day out basis.
I think it's also easier, Drew, when you look at it. It's a similar thing to Gretzky. Now, Popeye Jones doesn't have the name that Wayne Gretzky has, but the idea that Wayne Gretzky's son plays baseball, he doesn't have to play the same, he's not playing the same sport as his dad. His dad can be supportive and teach him the ways, but it's in a different kind of way. And I think that really does benefit the child.
He's not going to micromanage his career in terms of drills or on-ice performance, but he's going to micromanage his career in explaining and educating what it takes to stay as a peak athlete at the top of your profession on a night-in, night-out basis. How you go about, how you have to find sort of another level on those nights where you just don't feel as though you really want to be there. And we all have those nights where we don't feel as though you have it in your legs. You have to find the, and it's cliche, the intestinal fortitude in order to fight through those nights and still perform at the level that your teammates and your team expect of you.
I think that's a Jerry West quote in the Lakers locker room. I think it's something to the effect of, if you only work out or work hard on the days that you feel good, you're not going to get anywhere in life.
Well, that's a good point. It's fighting through those bad days. Now, obviously we speak very highly of Seth Jones.
Well, it's Drouin and the comparables that Button lists, and Craig Button, knowledgeable hockey man, that he lists that you say, hold on a second. I mean, that's high praise.
Yeah, and the two names that he mentions as being comparable to Jonathan Drouin, Denis Savard and Pat LaFontaine. I mean, if you're drafting Pat LaFontaine or Denis Savard in the top three, if you're taking them third overall, you're running to the bank and laughing.
Well, if you see the goal that he scored the other day in the QMJHL, that's the type of goal that, makes you just jump out of your seat. I mean, he almost looks like, to me, almost like a hybrid of Le Cavalier and St. Louis combined. I mean, Drouin looks like a really good player, and I think, as opposed to past years, Tyler versus Taylor, I think it's a three-man race, and obviously that's why we're talking about it. And this is by the way, considered a good draft. It's considered a strong draft.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, though. Nathan MacKinnon has been talked about for so long. He's been talked about for, I bet you it's almost been 3 or 4 years at this point in time, that people have been talking about Nathan MacKinnon, and it's going to be similar with Connor McDavid, the 15-year-old who got special exemption to play in the OHL. Mm-hmm. You know, have we been talking about Nathan MacKinnon for so long that we're beginning to sort of poke holes that may not necessarily be there just because we have to find warts in a guy?
100%. That happened to a player that Jets fans love to talk about, Sean Couturier. You know, he played for so long and was so well and thought of,
yep,
that he fell all the way down to 8, I guess it was, with Philly. And some in the game thought, and you know, he might be a little bit limited offensively, but some in the game thought, this guy's been so good for so long that people were just finding things to criticize him about. And that's the day and age we're in with the media. And we're part of that. Is these become storylines?
Not us though. The other media.
Yeah, the other media. like Remus. Now, but you have stuff to talk about, and then you talk about it for so long, and you know it's a classic case of a guy like Scheifele, for example. Nobody had seen really. Nobody had really heard of. So you don't pick apart his game as much as you do Couturier. So we'll see what happens with those two players who will be linked forever. But it's that idea that a Drouin who hasn't been. Who's always been well thought of, but really taken the next step this year. Now he's been a little bit more obviously visible. But prior to this year, Drouin wasn't being scrutinized as highly and as closely as Nathan MacKinnon and Seth Jones.
Well, it's funny, Richie, too, when these teams and scouts and GMs, they get together, they are, and especially when it's the higher picks, the first rounders, the second rounders, they pick apart everything in a guy's game. But I think really at the end of the day, when it comes down to evaluating these guys, you don't want to necessarily look at what they've just done. You got to look at everything. Mm-hmm. And you could say the same. You mentioned Couturier. I think it would be a bad mistake by hockey guys to look at Drouin and say, okay, well, what if he's just playing really, really well now? Or it's so hard. You can never really truly know how it's going to translate. There's a list of guys, over the years who their talents didn't transfer over to the NHL. But again, this is a strong draft, and Drouin is tearing up the QMJHL. So I think that, I think Craig Button, if we have him on the show next time, he might say somebody might take Drouin first overall.
It's certainly possible. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
We welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show our good friend from the Montreal Gazette, Pat Hickey. Pat, good morning. How are you?
I'm great, guys.
That's good. Glad to hear it. Pat, we got to start with the Michael Ryder, Eric Cole trade. That was obviously probably the most newsworthy event in the land of the Montreal Canadiens this week. What were your initial thoughts on that deal?
Well, this is what it comes down to, basically a business deal. Cole had 2 years left on his contract at $4.5 million. I think that Mark Bergevin, who didn't give him the contract originally, looked at it, said, this is a guy who's skills will probably, decline over those last 2 years. It's a chance to open up some cap space, put his mark on the team. Cole was signed by Mark Bergevin, and Cole actually got off to a very slow start. Ironically, the last two or three games before the trade, he was playing very well, and he started to pick up his pace. It looked like he got some of the conditioning back. He was hurt for a good part of the summer. Was rehabbing a back injury, was actually on the Canadiens injured list until about a month and a half into the lockout. So he had a slow start, but he was starting to come on. But, basically they got a similar player for a shorter term and less money. Ryder's making $3.5 million, which is $1 million less than Cole was. And his contract's up at the end of this year, so they can say goodbye to him or try to sign him for less money.
Pat, during the lockout, everyone heard the comments that Eric Cole made about, after the lockout was over, he was going to retire after this season. And also, we heard rumors that There were problems between Eric Cole and PK Subban in the Habs dressing room. I guess two-part question. Do you think Cole's comments during the lockout had any impact on the trade? And, you know, were there any issues between Eric Cole and PK Subban that you're aware of in the dressing room?
I'll answer the first one. There were no issues at all between PK Subban and Cole. I mean, I think when PK came back, several of his teammates, you know, went to him and said, look, you know, we've got a good thing going here. You know, it'd be good if you could tone your style down, you know, tone the rhetoric down a little bit, and he's done that. But there's no animosity in the room. PK knew that, you know, it was going to be, you know, he was going to have to come in and prove himself, and he did. As far as the comments he made, Cole was very frustrated by the lockout. He was upset the terms of the settlement. You know, he said, well, you know, I'm not getting all the money that I signed for, and he was unhappy about that. He was also concerned. He spent a lot of time with his family during the off season. He's a real family guy, and I think he enjoyed it. And, you know, the idea of going back to work wasn't really appealing to him. And, you know, I think he's got all the money he needs. He's not a free-spending guy and, as I say, very, very family-oriented guy. And I think that in a moment of frustration, he really meant that. He was also concerned about his daughter's schooling here in Quebec. Not the quality of the schools here, but the fact that eventually he would be moving back to the States. And there would be things that you would be missing, like, for example, American history, mm-hmm. which is a big deal in the United States. So, you know, there were all these concerns that were weighing on his mind, and I think that affected his play in the beginning, too. You know, I don't think his mind was really into it. But, you know, being a competitive guy, and there's no doubt that he's one of the most competitive guys on the team, as soon as he started playing and got into it, then, you know, things improved, and as I say, he was playing his best hockey at the end.
Pat, Michel Therrien is coming his second tour of duty with the Habs, and you covered the first one, and you're obviously covering the second one. The Habs are at the top of the conference right now, but the main question I have in terms of Therrien is, what has changed from the first time around to the second time around in terms of his coaching style, maybe his dealing with the media and other things?
Well, we talk about maturity in players, and there you see maturity in coaching. His first time around, he was a first-year NHL coach. And I think what he wanted to do was he wanted to prove that he belonged there and he was going to be the tough guy. And, you know, I think that over the years, he's mellowed. He had the famous meltdown in Montreal in the playoffs mm-hmm. against Carolina, where he's screaming and yelling at the referee, gets an unsportsmanlike conduct penalty, which probably leads to Carolina's comeback, and then Carolina goes on to win the cup. Then he had the experience in Pittsburgh, and of course we saw the famous meltdown there where he accused his team of trying to be the worst defensive team in the history of hockey. And you know, I think these things, you know, what happens is after a while coaches realize that they have to change their style a little bit, particularly the way things are in the NHL. I'm not saying the players are softer than or more fragile than they have been in the past, but I think you realize that there has to be a combination of use the hammer when you have to, but you've got to try to get all the guys on your side. And one of the things he's done is he's gotten this team to buy into a team concept. There's a lot of talk about it, a lot of talk about accountability. And in this case, Therrien has delivered. If you look at that seven or eight guys who have at least 10 points, it seems every night a different line steps up. And the other thing he's done is the whole accountability issue. For example, when PK came back, he eased him into the lineup slowly. He didn't give him the ice time that PK might have expected. When Cole struggled early in the season, he didn't get the ice time. And that's in stark contrast to last year when Randy Cunningworth took over from Jacques Martin, and he talked a lot about accountability. But Rennie Bork, who was just a dog last year, was getting 18 minutes every game. And so it's hard to say, you know, you're going to ask for accountability. And the other guys, you know, some of the younger guys who are getting 10, 12 minutes a game, were looking around saying, hey, what's going on here?
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Pat Hickey of the Montreal Gazette. Pat, the guy who hired Michel Therrien is Marc Bergevin, and he sort of really seems like a bit of an inspired general manager choice thus far. Didn't back down on the PK Subban RFA saga, made the signing of Brandon Proust, made the Eric Cole trade, hired Therrien. So far, does he get a grade of an A so far in his tenure as Montreal GM?
He might get an A+. Wow. I mean, he hasn't made too many mistakes. It's you know, one of the things he's done is that he came in and said, I don't have all the answers, which is a stark contrast to the two guys before him who thought they did have all the answers and didn't rely on the people they had in jobs, particularly, you know, some of the scouts. And, you know, a great example was, you know, the Canadians trading Ryan McDonagh. Mm-hmm. Because they, you know, Bob Gainey didn't feel that he played very well in a particular college game, and despite Trevor Timmons, who saw McDonagh multiple times and said, hey, this guy's going to be a star in the NHL, which he is. So one of the things that Bergevin did, he came in and said, I don't have all the answers. I'm going to get the best people around me. And he's hired Rick Dudley, who used to be a general manager. He's got Larry Carrière, a holdover from the previous regime. These are two of the best talented evaluators around. He brought in Marty Lapointe to work with some of the younger players. His work was particularly instrumental in working with Galchenyuk when he was in Sarnia at the beginning of the season. He brought back Patrice Brisebois to do some things. Scott Mellenby, similar role to Marty Lapointe. He revamped the coaching staff in Hamilton. And so, you know, what he's done is he's surrounded himself with really good people. He was smart enough, while he did some house cleaning, he was smart enough to keep Trevor Timmons, the amateur scout, who's done a great job in the draft. So, you know, what he's done is he's assembled a good staff of people around him to advise him, and he takes their advice.
Pat, if you had to pick one reason for the team's turnaround and their success, you know, being in first place in the Eastern Conference, would Andrei Markov's health be that reason?
Well, Andrei Markov's health would certainly be a factor in it. One of the things, I think one of the reasons why they've turned around is they weren't that bad to begin with. Mm-hmm. If you go back and look, 3 years ago they reached the Eastern Final. 2 years ago they took Boston, the eventual Stanley Cup champions, to seven games, lost in double overtime in game seven. So this was a pretty good team. Now, last year they had Markov missed 80% of the season. You had Brian Gionta missed more than half the season. Scott Gomez missed more than half the season. The general manager, Pierre Gauthier, made some insane trades. He brought in Chris Campoli, who, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a reason why Chris is not in the NHL right now, and it's not because he was on the negotiating committee. You have, you know, he traded Yaroslav Spachik, who's a popular guy in the room, for Thomas Cavalier, whose career is, you know, effectively over. He's playing now because they have some injuries, but, you know, he's just not, you know, not the same player he was 5 years ago. So they had all sorts of problems, injuries, you know, down the stretch, Travis Moan got hurt, and also they changed coaches in midstream. That was the general manager saving his own butt. And I think if they had kept Jacques Martin around, I'm not sure whether they would have made the playoffs, but they would have been more competitive than they were. They certainly wouldn't have finished last. And so there were all these factors that went into it. And I thought coming into this year, they would be pretty good. Now you get Gionta and Markov back and healthy. So, in effect, you've added two players. You've got these two young kids, Brendan Gallagher and Alex Galchenyuk. Just outstanding. I mean, you know, these kids are mature and just a delight to be around in the dressing room. So, you know, you've done some Diaz and Emmett Yemelin, the two European defensemen who were rookies last year, are playing much better, much improved. And Carey Price is a year older and more mature, better player.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're joined by Pat Hickey of the Montreal Gazette.
You mentioned Pat Diaz and Emelin there. Can you talk about their progression as you know, young, productive players on the back end?
Yeah, well, these guys are actually in their, they're in their mid-20s. Mm-hmm. They waited a while before coming to North America. Now, Diaz has a concussion right now, and they're hoping that's not too serious. But he actually claims that his improvement this year stems from playing in Switzerland during the lockout and playing with a lot of NHL players over there. And he said that helped him quite a bit, getting lots of ice time, being the number one defenseman on a team. Yemelin still is struggling a little bit with the language, but I think that's, being more comfortable with the language. He doesn't speak to the reporters, but you can see him talking on the bench with other players. And I think that has added to his, to what he can do out there. Very physical player. He's the most physical player on the team. He's one of the team, he's one of the leaders in the league in hits. And that's something the Canadiens haven't really had. They've had a lot of, mobile, skilled defensemen, but they haven't had guys that can hit and, make teams afraid to come across the blue line.
Pat, just final question here. The hockey lovers in Winnipeg have been giving Perry Pern a little bit of a hard time so far this season with the Jets struggling special teams. Pern was in Montreal for a period of time and was unceremoniously fired early into last season. Can you just talk about Perry Pern? I'm not sure how much you know about him in terms of how he was received in Montreal, what his strengths were, and kind of what people should know about him?
Well, I think he's a great coach. I thought that it was unfortunate they made him the scapegoat early in the season. They were trying to send a message to Jacques Martin. Again, it was one of the insane things that Pierre Gauthier did, and basically trying to protect himself. But Perry's he's a great, first of all, he's a really good man, and he's a really good coach. He's a good X and O's guy. I'm not sure what his problems are in Winnipeg. But he did a great job with special teams here in Montreal. So,
I think his problems in Winnipeg are, Pat, are obsessive fans, which you know a lot about.
Yeah, well, fans can do that. They sometimes there are expectations that don't fit the reality. But as I say, every place he's been a very good coach. I have a lot of respect for Perry as a person and as a coach.
Pat Hickey from the Montreal Gazette, thank you for joining us this morning on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Great insight into the Canadiens, as always.
I'm there for you anytime, guys.
Appreciate that, Pat. Have a good one.
Right.
Thanks a lot, Pat.
Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290 and the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.